The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Jim Cronin from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall be reading to you from the Reader's Digest and Consumer Reports. Okay, let's start off with The View from Gun Country. One Alabama's woman's experience as an observer and as a shooting victim underscores how hungry Americans are to reach consensus. I was shot on a Sunday. It was late and it was hot, and I was 21 on my way home from dinner during a summer break. I rolled the windows down because the breeze felt good. I pulled up to a red light about half a mile from my home in Tuscaloosa, Alabama. Yay by Usher was playing on the radio. A silver Toyota Tacoma turned the corner. As it passed me, I heard a pop, then my left arm was on fire. It never occurred to me to call 911, only to want my dad. I pulled into the Circle K across the street to call him. I looked at the blood blooming across my blue dress. It was new, and I wondered where the stain would come out. Then I looked over at a girl standing in the parking lot talking with two boys. Her wavy blonde hair shimmered beneath fluorescent floodlights. I thought about how I wish I had wavy blonde hair like hers. My dad said to stay put, that he'd come get me. I insisted on driving home. On the way, I apologized to God for the things I'd done wrong in life. When I pulled into the driveway, my parents were standing outside. My mother cried as she drove me to the hospital. The surgeon said the bullet was small, maybe .22 caliber, and too deep in the muscle to take out, so it's still there in my arm. They never caught the shooter or came up with a motive. Where I'm from, we like guns. They're as much a part of our story as Jesus, Roll Tide, and monograms. Even if you never shot one, you appreciate the romance. That appreciation begins when you're young. Here is what I remember. Excuse me, had a throat-clearing issue. Appreciation begins when you're young. Here's what I remember. November air, stadium lights, cut grass. We cheerleaders would stay after school to practice our halftime routine on Friday nights. We'd crowd in from fall bathroom mirrors to touch up our makeup. Glitter eyeshadow. It was a big game. And emerge in a fog of hairspray. The cheerleaders who were most envied were the ones who had their alarm clock set for 4 a.m. the next day. It meant they had a boyfriend who was taking them hunting. And that meant they were getting serious. Not every girl was excited about hunting itself. The gear was bulky and heavy rubber boots and a big camo jacket, which if you were lucky and had a brother, you could just borrow from him. The boy would pick you up in his truck and drive you out to his family's land. You climb into the deer stand and wait. The boy would have his rifle ready, maybe a .30-06, a youth model that didn't kick too hard. And when his prey finally emerged, he squeezed the trigger and you jumped because the sound cracked open the sky. A few horribly boring hours for you, but when his face flushed with delight, you remember why you came, because it was important to him, which meant it was important to you, too. Those morning weren't about guns so much as they were about growing up, the pride of inclusion and culture, the proximity to a masculine energy we all found intoxicating. If people in Tuscaloosa talked about gun violence at all, it was in the wake of a mass shooting. After the rare hunting accident, it was an unfortunate but inexplicable hit. Bit of collateral damage. Occasionally cars hit people, but we still drive. When I was 14, my grandfather became a co-owner of an outdoor store. The store carried everything, firearms, fishing equipment, hiking and camping gear. After I got shot, after I was able to sleep on my left side again, I started thinking about the gun section at the back of the store. Did the person who shot me buy the weapon there? How long did the sale take? I pictured him, his face was in my mind, but always a man, selecting a gun, then tossing in a pack of chewing gum because it was right there by the cash register, and why not? Probably I had parroted the fortunate but justifiable collateral hit bit before. That logic became muddled, though, when the collateral damage was me. But nobody talked about it like that, at least not out loud. For a while, neither did I. Getting shot did not end my life. It didn't even upend it, really. The one time I cried, I was sitting in a tufted chair in my parents' bedroom while the local Fox affiliate was on. The victim, the anchor said, is still rattled, but at home and doing fine. We can exclusively report. It was a disembodying listen to this person I never spoke with speak about me. We can exclusively report. Each time I replayed that night in my mind, a different image would surface. My four-year-old sister in the driveway when I pulled in. When I got out, she saw the deep red side of my dress. The blood stained like a Rorschach pattern. She pointed at it and calmly said, "You got shoot on your dress." in the hospital nursing emergency room desk looked up from her phone and said expressionless, "We've got a gunshot wound." There were not the details the police wanted me to remember. Like detectives on a TV show, they asked me to close my eyes but relive the drive. The way the air smelled, the sound of the other cars. But I could not conjure the missing fact that would give meaning to all the others. A beer can clattering across the street for some reason. They seemed I might have heard a beer can clattering across the street. I traveled the next week to France for a writing class. The bullet does not set off metal detectors, but I carried a letter about it from the sheriff just in case. In the fall, I went back to college in New England, where the story of the lead inside my arm was just that, a story. But like the ugliest white noise, it was always there with me, defiant and relentless. After late nights on the library, I'd call the campus police, wary of the 3 stoplights I had to pass on my way home. I'd ask the woman who usually worked at that hour to stay on the line with me while I walked. Sometimes a friend would ask whether my feelings on gun rights had changed. I usually said, "I don't know." And that was true. Knee-jerk calls for gun control didn't resonate with me. Yet a reverence towards guns no longer felt right either. I find my ambivalence unsettling. Everyone else seems sure about how to feel about guns, people on campus, on the internet, back home. Unlike most of them, I had made intimate acquaintance with gun violence. I should have had some special insight. If what had happened to me wasn't fodder for clarity, I feel nothing else ever would be. In February 2018, a few days after 34 high school students and faculty were gunned down, 17 fatally in Parkland, Florida, my grandfather called me in Washington, D.C., where I now work as a congressional reporter. He wanted to talk about what happened. We'd never discussed gun control before. After I got shot, we talked about me. We talked about the reporters and TV trucks parked outside my dad's office. We talked about the dead-end police investigation. Never, though, about the gun. After Parkland, we did. My grandfather said that something had to be done about all this, and it didn't look like anyone up there, meaning Washington, was going to do a damn thing about it. I could picture his brow furrowed, his head shaking. He said that when he learned the killer in Parker had used an AR-15-style semi-automatic rifle, he'd asked one of the store managers to call the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms and Explosives to find out whether the store could stop selling those types of weapons to people under the age of 21. The woman there said it could. It was a private business, but it would risk age discrimination lawsuits. My grandfather told me he didn't care much about risks, so he'd ordered the change. He'd also considered pouring AR-15s from the shelves altogether, but first he'd had his employees look into who regularly buys them. Turns out most customers are landowners and farmers with a wild hog issue. The pigs burrowed into their property, digging up roots and acorns and generally tearing up the ground, making it difficult to run equipment over the land. Because the animals are often traveling in herds, a semi-automatic rifle is particularly efficient because of stopping them. For that reason, my grandfather said he continued to sell the gun. We talked about how hiking the age for AR-15 purchases was unlikely to stop the next Parkland. Still, it felt good to do something, anything. The problem is a complicated one, he said, and the only thing most politicians seemed able to do was serve up broad-stroke talking points or say nothing at all. On Capitol Hill, I'd watched up close as apathy had settled in after earlier shootings. I could predict the response of each party's leaders. I could recite the thoughts and prayers, all of which had begun to feel like a mockery of God, of the brains he'd given us to figure it out. I found myself thinking of 1 Peter 4:10. Each of you should use whatever gift you have received to serve others, as faithful stewards of God's grace in various forms. If my grandfather, a middle-of-the-road Republican, who'd voted for Donald Trump, could see the many grays of this very American problem, I thought, why couldn't Washington? Soon after our talk, I went home for a visit. My grandfather picked me up from my parents' house. As we drove, I told him I was writing an article about what it was like getting shot in a place that loves guns. It's not love, he said. We pulled into the parking lot of his store, which sits high on a hill. You can see almost all of Tuscaloosa from there. It's about necessity, he mentioned, rattlesnakes and coyotes. For people in rural areas, that's more than 40% of Alabamians. Guns are still a day-to-day defense against such animals. Yet there is ample love for guns in Alabama, but to forget that they're toes is a missing important point. We walked into the store. It smelled like pine. In the back left corner was the gun room, its name announced in a tall brown letters beneath a taxidermied leopard. For the next few hours, I watched employees handle firearms with care bordering on devotion. They spoke with pride. I can see how expertise on something so complicated, so controversial, so lethal, might feel gratifying. Reed Duvall, a tall 20-something with Santhi-colored hair, was at the counter that morning. Back in Washington, I'd spent months talking with Republican lawmakers who bristled at the notion of common-sense solutions to gun violence. Proposed gun control measures reflected anything but common sense, they told me. Moreover, the National Rifle Association was stridently against them on the grounds that almost any concession would undermine the Second Amendment. But Duvall, who described himself as a very pro-Second Amendment, seemed to suggest this argument was insincere. It just makes sense, stuff like age restrictions, he told me. There's a certain market maturity level required for guns in general, and especially with something like an AR-15. Some people probably shouldn't have them. It occurred to me that guys like Duvall and the others in the counter had had their voices hijacked by people like Caitlin Bennett. She marked her graduation from Kent State University in 2018 with a photo of herself shouldering an AR-10 and holding her cap, which she decorated with the words, "Come and take it." The photo went viral, and now Bennett posts incendiary tweets designed to elicit liberal tears. That the broader population has transferred the attitudes of people like Bennett into most gun owners is understandable. Popular discourse is given to extremes, but gun owners' representatives, ostensibly sent to Washington to cut through the morass, appear guilty of the same. In all the times I've talked with GOP lawmakers about guns, they have never mentioned that age restrictions are, for many conservative voters, a worthwhile starting point. Better question, do they even know? I don't know, said another employee, Morgan Pate. It's not like they ask us. I hated what had happened to me, and I hated what had happened to the children in Parkland. I wanted to hate guns, too. That's how I thought a good person should feel. I'd recatalog my ambivalence from unsettling to irresponsible, even immoral, and yet it remained. Two nights after visiting the store, I went shooting with an old friend I'll call Tyler. I'd reach out to him in hopes that he could help me remember things about hunting, about home I'd forgotten. We stopped by his house to pick up his Labrador and some beer, then headed to some land he owned about 45 minutes out town to kill some hogs. When we got to his cabin, the alarm was blaring, and we were wondering whether there'd been a break-in. Not that there would have been much to take, apart from the television with rabbit ears. Still, it felt good to walk in with someone who was armed. Tyler looked around, holding his AR-15 over his shoulder, all clear. He grabbed boots and wool socks from a closet. I pulled them on, and we doused ourselves in bug spray. We walked outside to unload the truck. Tyler fired three shots into the sky. Pop, pop, pop. I jumped backward, shielding my face with my forearms. I yelled his name. He laughed. What? I held myself in that space before tears, where your cheeks warm and pressure builds in the back of your throat. I hadn't expected to be scared. We climbed into an all-terrain vehicle and staked it through the woods into an open field. Here we were, surrounded by miles of tall grass, power lines dissolved into the horizon on either side. The sky was lavender. The plan was to wait. As minutes bled into hours, we were comfortable in the ATV, talking about our 10-year plans. I didn't have one. He thought that was risky. The gun and the Labrador resting between us. Any anxiety I felt early was gone. I don't buy into the idea that regular people are more sensible intrinsically than creatures of D.C., but they are certainly more complicated than their leaders care to admit. Lawmakers of both parties are alienating reasonable and responsible gun owners out of deference to extremists. Acknowledging the ambiguities, the gray areas of American attitudes towards guns, all things that can make gun violence victim want to go shooting at a firearms dealer, decide to regulate his own shop, won't solve this problem single-handedly stem gun deaths, but continue to see things in the current terms pretty much guarantees that we'll get nowhere. As my evening with Tyler wore on, no hogs appeared, but I wanted to shoot the AR-15, so Tyler proposed target practice. He walked out into the field and balanced empty cans on top of one another. I nestled the stock into my shoulder, steadied the red dot on the top can, and pulled the trigger. The can exploded into the air, a blue blur. A piercing ring followed and made the rest of the world seem still. I caught the metallic scent of gunpowder. The best smell in the whole world, Tyler said. I snapped on the safety, and he restacked the can so I could go again. The same deafening pops that had almost seemed firing a few hours earlier now set loose a sweet dose of adrenaline. I was happy. I didn't want to be. Where we agree, gun control is one of the most polarizing political issues we face today. Or is it? There is no doubt that the topic generates fierce opinions from both sides. but on many questions about how to reduce the number of gun-related deaths, something 85% of Americans say they are concerned about. There's far more agreement than the debaters or politicians let on. In fact, a recent Ipsos Reuters poll found that only 37% of Americans are even somewhat confident their elected officials understand their views on guns. If the public service in Washington want to follow the wall of people, including the 42% of Americans who have a gun at home, according to Pew Research, they should start by looking at these areas where the vast majority of Americans agree we need federal gun laws in place, according to recent national polls. 94% requiring background checks for all gun buyers. 86% favor banning people with a history of mental illness from buying a gun. 84% favor prohibiting anyone on the no-fly list from buying a gun. 83% support limiting gun purchase to those 21 and older. 80% think there should be a mandatory 3-day waiting period before someone can take home a gun. 80% favor tracking gun sales through a federal database. 77% report requiring a license before buying a gun. And 73% support banning high-capacity magazines, automatic action-meaning features that hold in more than 10 rounds. Drama in real life, buried in the snow. An avalanche turned a luxury hotel into an icy coffin with little chance of finding survivors, but rescuers refused to stop digging through the debris. He was pinned in the darkness by the weight of beams and walls, ice and earth. What happened? Where am I? Lying on his stomach, he surveyed what he could. His left leg had been twisted and thrust forward, so that his foot rested near his cheek. He could move his left arm, but his right arm and leg were crushed beneath something enormous. He realized with horror that his chin rested on the knee of a corpse. He tried to still the panic, to recall moments before everything went dark. He had been speaking to his wife. They were standing in a doorway, and then the whistling gust of wind, the sense of tumbling through space, the sounds of coughing, moaning, and the horrified silence that followed. Had it been an earthquake? He called his wife but heard no answer. Giampado! Giampaolo! A woman cried. She was close. She was trapped in here. Are you alive? I'm alive, he shouted. I'm alive. Nestled on the flanks of Italy's Apennine Mountains, about 100 miles northeast of Rome, the Hotel Regio Pauno has never been easy to reach. But its isolation only added to its appeal, attracting Italian pop stars and other celebrities such as George Clooney. In January 2017, snow began to fall across the Apennines. For days it came down, and the enormous drifts ringing the Rigopiano grew taller by the hour. From his home in the Rome suburb, Giampaolo Matroni watched the weather with concern. He and his wife, Valentina Ciccioni, had planned on an overnight getaway to the hotel. But now I wonder whether they should go. Matroni found the Rigopiano. Its owner, Roberto Del Rosso, said Matroni simply needed a change on his tires. Tranquillo, Don Rosso said. It won't be a problem. What Del Rosso kept to himself was that things were going bleak. Food and supplies at his hotel were running low, and with only single snowplow, officials in town were struggling to keep the road open. Baroni and Ciccioni did not know that. They decided to make the trip. By the time they neared the resort 6 hours later, they were battling a total whiteout. When they finally reached the hotel, they were cold and exhausted. They checked into the room and headed outside to the thermal pool, trying to forget their long day and the call. The wind and the thick, wet snow were unrelenting. Soon they retreated indoors to get dressed for dinner. The conversation there was troubling. More scared than you, a waiter confided to them. I've been stuck here for 6 days. And there's a picture of the hotel. It's a beautiful-looking building in the mountains. As the guests awoke on Wednesday, January 18th, they discovered that their predicament had worsened overnight. The cars in the lot were invisible. The phone and power lines were down. Cellular coverage, always spotty in the mountains, had gotten worse. Employees in the kitchen were hard to manage what was left of the provisions. For breakfast, they put out a few microwave croissants, some marmalade and Nutella. After breakfast, Matroni and Ciccioni went to the jacuzzi. Matroni sank near the surface. Suddenly, the hotel began to wobble. The windows rattled and the water in the tub sloshed over the edges. An earthquake with a magnitude of 5.7 had struck the mountains. Maroney had had enough. Let's get out of here, he told his wife, dressing quickly. They headed to the parking lot where others were excavating their cars. 15 minutes after the first earthquake, another tremor hit, this one measuring 5.6. With a dozen vehicles freed, guests set off down the driveway. But when they reached the main road, the path was blocked by a 6-foot-high wall of snow. Maroney climbed out of his car and scaled the drift. There was no road, just a glistening exempt of powder. He turned and yelled down to his wife, "We're trapped," and they waded their way back to the resort. As the light outside faded, the 40 guests and workers watched for distraction, searched for distraction. Adriana Vishananu and her son huddled over a checkerboard in a playroom on the ground floor. She needed aspirin and sent her husband, Giovanni Peretti, to find some in their car. Meanwhile, their daughter shot pool with two older children down the corridor in the billiard hall. A handful of guests sat in a white-upholstered armchairs and sofas. Moroni paced the reception area, anxiously discussing options with his wife. Del Rosso, the owner, was just around the corner in the hotel's library nook. Half a dozen of his employees milled about in the kitchen. That was in the snow, and the mountain began to slide. They heard the avalanche before they saw it. As a wall of snow and ice tumbled downward, it compressed the air into a terrible low whistle. The avalanche gathered speed and size, grabbing rocks and trees and anything else in its way as it roared down the mountain. With a fourth of 4,000 fully loaded Mack trucks, the snow slammed into the hotel at 60 miles per hour. Walls buckled. The avalanche floundered through the kitchen, killing the workers there. It tore above the alcove where Rodorso was, and then raced across the two rooms where guests sat sipping hot drinks. The snow and the weight of everything it had brought down the mountain with it ripped the hotel from its foundation, collapsed it into a pile of rubble, and sent debris flying more than 100 yards away. When the tossing and tumbling came to a stop, those caught inside were left buried in the icy heap of neck and ruck and ruin. It was now still. Everything had gone dark. Fabio Salzetta, the resort's caretaker, had been working in the tiny boiler hut about 30 yards from the main building when he noticed an eerie silence. He tried to throw open the door, but it wouldn't budge. The little outbuilding was sealed in snow, so he pried away the window frame and wiggled outside. Standing on an empty snowfield, he gazed at a trail of sheer destruction. It was as if a giant rake had been dragged down the mountain, toppling beech trees, crushing cars, chewing up everything in his path. Suzetta felt numb. Where was the hotel? Then he saw the top of Rigopioni's roof parking out of a pyramid of ice top rubble. The entire building had been bulldozed down the hill. So Zetta noticed a figure stumbling across the go. Giampiero Pirette. Moments before the avalanche had struck, he had gone to get aspirin for his wife from their car. Pirette appeared disoriented, distraught. My family is inside the hotel. The two climbed inside Peretti's car, finding a cell signal with Peretti's phone. It seemed to take forever. In fact, it took 2 hours before they finally spoke with the chief of the Pine Rescue Team, Antonio Crescetta. We're coming, Crescetta. How long will it take, Pirette? 5 or 6 hours. Darkness had set in, and Pirette and Cicetta sat afraid inside the car, motor running, heat now blasting. And there's a before and after picture of the hotel. It's a 3 or 4 story hotel without buildings and a pool. Everything's a beautiful looking building. And the next picture, there's nothing left. Absolutely nothing. From his base on the hillside village of Penna Crocetta alerted the military police and mobilized his unit. 14 men trained in rescue operations, including a surgeon, an anesthetist, a dog handler, a search dog, and 2 veteran alpine guides. Reaching resort would mean trekking 6 miles up the mountains. When the rescuers finally arrived, 8 hours after Peretti had caught the Conchetta, there was no movement anywhere. No human sound, just rubble. They did spot 2 headlights, Saletta and Peretti in the car. How many people were in the hotel? A team member asked. About 40, Salzetta replied. Can you give us an idea where they might be? Alzetta offers his best guess. As rescuers wrapped Peretti in a thermal blanket and took him down the mountain on a stretcher, other members of the alpine team began probing with their sondas, tool used to poke through the snow to locate bodies. They found the first one after about an hour, buried under 5 feet of snow. It was Gabriele D'Angelo, one of Sazetta's colleagues. The maitre d' of the hotel restaurant was found buried nearby. Later, Del Rosso's body would be discovered beneath the rubble that crushed his hotel as his hotel disintegrated. While the alpine team probed for corpses, Giampaolo Matroni lay in a coffin-sized pocket of air beneath 30 feet of snow, ice, and rubble. He could hear nothing of what was happening at the surface. Shock had set in. He felt no pain, no hunger, no cold. He began to feed in and out of consciousness. Surreal imagery drifted through his mind. At one point, he was walking alongside his wife through the bakery his family operated, taking note of every shop, every street corner, every crack in the pavement. His thoughts were strange and richly detailed. He imagined rescuers swooping in on magic carpets, dressed like Aladdin in the Arabian Nights. In another vision, his best friend, a bodybuilder, materialized on the mountain, lifting tons of concrete and setting Moroni free. Each time Moroni awoke, he confronted a new terrible reality. He was buried alive. Despair washed over him. He asked himself, who is going to save us? The hotel, there's a picture of the hotel, which opened in 1950. It had been closed for a decade when it reopened in 2017, with a newly built spa above, which is now in total, complete rubble. The next morning, Thursday, more rescuers arrived, including a team of firefighters and canine trainer Lorenzo Botti. Looking at the remains of the hotel, Botti made a quick assessment. No chance of survivors. Police technicians set up an antenna that allowed them to home in on buried cell phones. Whenever there were phones, they would find people, or more likely, bodies. Botti turns his attention to the 30-foot mound buried under snow. That constituted the main structure of the hotel. After studying a crude floor plan driven by Salzetta, Botti and his men mounted the wreckage, shoveled through 13 feet of snow, and then they found the top of the building, began sawing into the roof. Rescuers carefully lowered themselves into the apertures they cut. Lights fastened to the helmet illuminated the twisted debris. The space was so cramped, the registers had to crawl on their bellies. For hours, they called for survivors. Finally, at 11 a.m. on Friday, more than 30 hours after the search began, they heard something astonishing. A woman crying for help. Who are you? One of the rescuers back. I am Adriana. How many are you? I'm in a room with my sons, she said. My daughter's inside in the next room. Adriana Vashinu, whose husband had gone to fetch her aspirin from their car before the avalanche, and then frantically phoned for help, was bleeding from a head wound when firefighters found her, and her sons squeezed together in a crawl space. They were led to safety. Finding survivors electrified the rescuers. The firefighters turned quickly toward the nearby billion room, cut a small in the roof, focused on searchlight, and lowered a video probe. Gathering around the screen, saw two small kids emerge from behind a sofa, including Adriana's daughter, drawn by the light from the hole in the roof. Somehow, the entire room appeared intact. Through a hole in the wall, the firefighters found three more children. Stay calm, a rescuer said. Get on your bellies, move like a centipede. Carefully but quickly, the men ushered the children out of the rubble. Meanwhile, another squad of rescuers picked up a cell phone signal coming from a crawl space. They saw toward voices crying for help. Soon they found a young couple and a young woman, all of whom they pulled to safety. Who else is down here? A Roman guy, one of them said. Giampaolo Matroni. It was after midnight now. Saturday, January 21st, some 55 hours since the avalanche. The rescue team had been working nonstop for more than 2 days. The wreckage was frighteningly unstable. As they moved, the rescuers knew that the force of their digging, or another tremor, could bring it all down on them. Paolo De Quinzio and three other rescuers buried on, breaking blade after blade on the circular saws, battling toward a faint cell signal detected deep in the ruins. Suddenly they heard a voice. They silenced their saws and listened. It was Matroni. He was still fading in and out of consciousness. A vision of his wife, Valentina, hovered over him in an angel of mercy. He thought. She assured him he'd be okay. Giampano, we are here, De Quinzio shouted, 10 feet above where the trapped man lay. Are injured? Are you bleeding? As the voices and the buzzing of sounds grew louder, Matrone became more alert. Where is my wife? We put her in her car because it's cold, De Quinzio lied. At last, at around 6 in the morning, De Quinzio's saw broke through a final thick layer of insulation. He pointed his light toward the opening and spotted Matrone's back. De Quinzio could see how the angled beams had created a cocoon that prevented Matrona from being crushed to death. Those near him had not been as lucky. Squeezed into space for him were the bodies of two women, one supporting his head, one curled beneath his leg. Rescuers raised the concrete beam of Matrona's limbs with a hydraulic jack. You are a superhero, De Quinzio said as he reached beneath Matrona's arm fence and gently lifted him out of his tomb. The rescuers placed him on a mattress. Matroni gazed up at dozen faces silhouetted by the light of their headlamps. A cheer went up in the small crowd. Bravo! He was one of 11 people out of 40 to have survived. Soon after, he was airlifted to a hospital in a nearby town. Gangrene had burrowed deep into his right arm. The nerves of his right ankle had practically been destroyed. Had he been pulled out even 2 hours later, Matroni was told his arm would certainly have been lost. 5 days after his rescue, Matroni was given the heartbreaking news that his wife had died. Her body had been found, crushed by debris, near where Matroni had been trapped. The angel who had appeared to him in his final dreams had, unbeknownst to him, never left his side. And with that, let us wrap back over to Consumer Reports. And in last week, we were talking about when recalls fail. And we had done the thing on the first thing we did was on breast implants and contaminated chicken. Now we're going to reel on risky infant sleepers. When a family asked Haley and Ty Hampton what they needed in the birth of their twin boys, Liam and Lennox, the couple didn't hesitate. Two Fisher-Fies rock and play sleepers. Other new parents were raving about them. The Hamptons from Navajo, Alabama, wanted the babies to sleep in the couple's bedroom, but not in their beds, which they knew was dangerous. The rock-and-play sleepers were alternative, Ty says. But on February 20, 2019, when Ty went to give the twins their bottles, he noticed Liam's head was tilted oddly in the sleeper. According to a lawsuit the Hamptons filed against Fisher-Price, when Ty picked up the baby, his body was limp and cold. After frantic efforts to revive him, Liam was pronounced dead at the hospital. The Hamptons, devastated, had no idea what caused Liam's death. But less than 2 months later, they learned that dozens of other infants had died in rock-and-play sleepers, and the Fisher-Price and the CPC had known about the deaths for years. Like many Karens, Hamptons had assumed the sleeper was safe. But a CR investigation published in April found that it had never been adequately tested and posed several risks. Medical guidelines, babies should sleep on their backs, alone, unrestrained, on a firm, flat surface, free of soft bedding. But the rock-and-play sleeper positions babies at an angle about 30 degrees, which may cause a baby's head to tilt forward, compressing the airway, leading to suffocation. It also has soft padding and restraints, which increase the risk of suffocation and strangulation. It was only after CR linked the sleepers to at least 32 infant deaths going back to 2011 that Fisher-Price recalled almost 5 million of them. At least 54 infants are now known to have died in similar sleepers. William Wallace, CR's manager of home and safety policy, says the recall was long overdue. It's outrageous that Fisher-Price and the CPC knew about deaths and linked this product for years and didn't take steps that have prevented tragedies. When CR asked Fisher-Price in early April about the deaths associated with the rock-and-play sleeper, a company spokesperson says, "We do not believe any death has been caused by the product." And notice that some of the fatalities were due to mitigating circumstances or the product being used according to instructions. Now, how could so many deaths and not warrant a recall? At the heart of the holdover is a controversial law that restricts and sometimes prevents the CPSC from releasing companies and product-specific information, even when the products are connected to injuries and deaths. The law, called Section 6IB of the Consumer Product Safety Act, says that in most cases the agency must get a company's permission before it publicly reveals a safety problem. And once a company agrees to negotiate the terms of the alert, which can allow the company to downplay the problem. Proponents of 6B say that giving companies a chance to review safety concerns first, the law prevents the CPSC from unfairly damaging the company's reputation. Critics disagree. The gag that 6B places on CPSC is a dangerous anomaly, says C.R. Freeman. NHTSA would push for the recall of deadly Takata airbags because we had the freedom to share what we knew, he says. The CPSC can't do that. While the delayed recall of the rock-and-play sleeper and the lives lost while it stayed on the market is a glaring example of what can happen when products' hazards are shrouded in secrecy, it's not an isolated case. Section 6B also bid for years the number of tip-over deaths associated with IKEA furniture, delaying the recall of millions of dressers. By the way, there was just news this past week about IKEA settling for a huge sum for fall-over dressers. Though the CPC can technically mandate a recall, it really takes that step, in part because companies can sue the agency, says Pamela Gilbert, previously CPSC's executive director. The agency does not have an official stance on Section 6B, but two members, Robert Adler, acting chairman, and Elliot Kay, commissioner, have spoken against it. We need the anti-consumer safety and anti-transparency requirement of Section 6B to be eliminated, Kay said recently. People die because of Section 6B. It's that simple. Even when recalls are initiated, it's often hard to remove products from circulation. As CR's recent survey showed, most Americans don't hear about, much less respond to, product recalls. And most companies recalling products don't face strict requirements to reach out to consumers. As a result, recall completion rates are often less than 10%. According to the CPSC. In fact, 1 in 10 daycare centers are still using walk-and-play sleepers or other inclined sleepers month after the recalls were announced, according to a report focused on three states by USPRC and the Kids in Danger, two consumer safety advocacy groups. Industry should make the same multifaceted efforts they do to advertise their products to notify consumers about recalls, and then take more significant steps to retrieve recalled items, says Nancy Cowles, executive director of KED. The government needs to be a strong advocate for consumers by enforcing product safety regulations both pre- and post-market. KED is one of several groups, including the American Academy of Pediatrics and CR, that urges parents not to use infant-inclined sleepers and supports a bill banning them, which was introduced after the April recall. The CPSC alder explains that while recalls should be improved, we also need to keep dangerous products from getting into the market in the first place, he says. You want agencies like CPSC to be the fence at the top of the cliff, not the ambulance at the bottom. What consumers should do. Respond to recalls. If a product you own has been recalled, follow the manufacturer's instructions by calling the company or checking its website on how to repair or return it. You choose not to participate in a recall. Don't give the product away or sell it. Instead, throw it out so that it can't be used by others. Stay informed. Track recalls and safety alerts at recalls.gov, which are directed to each federal agency recall pages. That includes the Consumer Product Safety Commission, Household and Other Products, the Department of Agriculture and Meat, Poultry, and Egg Products, and the Food and Drug Administration, most other foods, medical devices, drugs, and supplements, and the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, vehicles, car seats, and related equipment. At each site, you can see recalls and sign up to receive small alerts. CR members can also track recalls related to recalls at car recalls. Report problems. Each agent recalls also provides a way for consumers to report problems related to the products regulates. Register your products. If your product comes with a registration card, don't toss it. Instead, fill it out and mail it to, or if possible, fill it out online. That allows the company to notify you if the product is recalled or needs a repair. Research responsible purchases. Research secondhand purchases. Though it's illegal for retailers and individuals to sell new and used products that have been recalled, some sellers, particularly of used goods, may not adhere to the state law, to this law, consistently. Policies are more uneven with used car dealers because federal law does not explicitly prohibit the sale of used vehicles with open recalls. When buying any used product from an individual, ask for the brand model, serial number, and date the product was manufactured. That information is often the product itself or any instruction manual. Also take extra care when buying used cars. Look up the VIN number and an HTSA recall thing to see whether the car is part of a recall. How future recalls can be better. Technology is already making the recall process safer and more efficient. In December 2016, owners of more than 100,000 Samsung Galaxy Note 7 phones, which were prone to battery fires, had failed to return their devices, despite earlier recalls. So Samsung, working with major U.S. carriers, pushed a software update that bricked the unreturned Note 7s. The update rendered the phones unusable, unable to charge or connect to a network. Robert Adley, acting chairman of the Consumer Product Safety Commission, thinks something similar, attaching wireless chips to consumer products, could improve recall rates. He envisions a future where the crib is flashing a red light that says, "Do not put your precious baby in me. I've been recalled, and here's what you do to fix the problem." Some net companies can already fix problems over the air. In 2018, CR found that the braking devices on the Tesla Model 3 was 152 feet at 50 miles an hour, worse than any other contemporary car. Tesla pushed a software update that cut the distance by 19 feet, putting in line with its peers. "I tested more than 1,000 cars," says Jake Fisher, director of auto testing at CR, "and I had never seen a car that could improve performance with an over-the-air update." Quick fixes can also introduce defects, Fisher calculates. Last year, XM pushed on an update that caused the infotainment system in some Fiat Chrysler models to endlessly reboot. Not only was it annoying, Fisher said, but it made the federally mandated backup camera useless. Still, despite these glitches, Fisher said, if we can get these updates right, it just might revolutionize the future of product and car safety. The Wheel Deal. To be confident in your tire purchase, use our ratings and advice for our experts who put tires through the most rigorous independent testing programs in the country. In a perfect world, tire purchases would be planned ahead of time so you research the best deals for a safe, high-performing product. This is especially true when winter approaches, the time when you're more likely to need extra grip to battle heavy rain, snow, and icy roads. But what if you got that? You get a flat that requires you to quickly replace one tire, and the other three are just fine. Or your mechanic surprises you with the news that your tires are worn and need to be replaced soon, maybe even right now? Buying under those conditions can be stressful, confusing, and expensive. That's why it's best to arm yourself ahead of time with expert insights drawn from CR's extensive tire testing program. Here we provide answers to tricky but common questions about buying tires, and results from our latest tire retailer survey can show you the best places to shop based on CR member experiences at a wide range of stores. What if I need to replace only a single tire? For a tire that's damaged beyond simple repair, you may be able to get away with replacing just that one if the other three show only light tread wear. If the other tire on the same axle shows significant wear, we suggest you buy at least two new matched tires. You want to put this new pair on the rear to ensure the vehicle's stability. For all wheel drive vehicles, you may have to replace all four tires because the AWD components can be particularly sensitive to mismatch. Following this advice will ensure balanced handling and traction at all corners. Plus, replacing all four tires means you're free to consider a different model with higher performance and longer tread life. More than 60% of CR members surveyed changed the brand and the model of their most recent tire purchase. It could also result in a better overall deal from the tire retailer. Here's a clever maneuver when buying just one tire. You can have the tread of a new tire shaved down by a machine to match the depth of the other three. This service costs $23 to $35 per tire through Tire Rack, an online retailer. Can I mix and match tire brands on the same car? We don't recommend this. Certainly never mix tire types, such as all season and winter snow, because it could be unsafe. If you decide to buy just one or two tires, stick with the brand and model already on the car. Of course, you want the same size, load index, how much weight each tire can support, and speed rating, too. This ensures that the vehicle dynamics are not upset by varying performance, which might pose a safety risk. How much can I trust tread wear predictions? The answer, it's very complicated. A tread wear rating known as Uniform Tire Quality Grading, or UTGQ, comparative rating. The higher the number, the longer the tread life. For example, a tire graded 400 will wear four times as long as one graded 100. Manufacturers assign grades for their own tires. The tread wear ratings, along with those for temperature and traction, are on the sidewall. Even so, there's no sided mileage that's easy for shoppers to understand. Tread wear warranties, which offer insurance based on miles used, do provide some guidance for shoppers. But it can still be largely an apples-to-oranges comparison from brand to brand. Real-world tread life depends on multiple factors such as vehicle, driving style, geography, tire pressure, road service, temperatures, and wheel alignment. To remove all this guesswork, CR predicts how long a tire will last based on its 16 or 20,000 miles of on-the-road testing and precise measurements. We conduct our extensive tread wear testing the same way within each category for a powerful apples-to-apples comparison across models. This provides a straightforward alternative to the UTOG ratings or mileage listed in the warranties. Get the best of those tread life in your tires, check the pressure monthly, and consult the owner's manual for the proper schedule to rotate the tires and perform wheel alignments, cut corners, and you could lose life from the tires. Is it worth getting a road hazard warranty? Road hazard warranties cover part or all the expense of replacing a tire damaged while in use. Many major tire retailers offer coverage either free or for a fee, an average of about $17 per tire, according to our survey. Some tire manufacturers also offered hazard warranties. In our survey, more members got a road hazard warranty free with the purchase of their tires than paid for it. Road hazard protection can come in handy, especially if you have a history of getting flats. Seek this as a perk from your tire retailer, but avoid paying extra unless you get a great deal. It should be noted that almost all tires carry some form of basic warranty from the manufacturers for defects. They're also referred to as materials and workmanship warranties. The coverage is typically limited to a specific time period or level of wear. Do I really need a four-wheel alignment with the purchase? Yes. an alignment which promotes even tread wear is key to making your tires last. This should be done when you buy a set of tires and in accordance with the maintenance schedule in your car owner's manual. Some tire retailers offer this as a free service. Should I buy all-season or winter snow tires? Most new cars come with all-season tires, a type engineered to provide good year-round performance. Winter snow tires, designated by a mountain snowflake symbol on the sidewall, are specially crafted to provide optimum traction in cold temperatures and have tread designs specifically for gripping snow. They're ideal for those who must travel through harsh snowy conditions, but they typically have a shorter road life, tread life, and their grip at cleared roads is typically not as good as that of all-season tires. Winter snow tires should be installed as a set of four just for the rough winter months and traditional all-season used for the rest of the year. A subcategory of tires called all-weather provides the balanced performance of all seasons, but with enhanced winter grip. They also have the mountain snowflake symbol denoting winter grip, yet they have the benefit of not needing to be changed seasonally. The all-weather tires we tested are noted and footnoted. Know your types. All-season tires are the most common type. They're used on cars, minivans, SUVs, and trucks. They're designed to handle most conditions, including dry and wet pavement and light or moderate snow. Performance all-season. Performance all-season tires provide year-round grip-tested, grip-tuned for enthusiastic driving. They are a step up from regular all-season tires, placing more emphasis on handling. Ultra-high performance all-season. These tires are commonly fit to upscale sedans or sporty vehicles. These tires are a significant step up from performance all-season tires, delivering higher levels of dry and wet grip and handling. But they give up some winter traction, and the tread life is shorter than that of performance off-season tires. All-season truck. These are designed to handle the service demands of SUVs and light-duty pickups. They are well-suited for most car conditions, including dry and wet powdered pavement and light as moderate snow, and then winter and snow. Tires in this category have a tread designed for better grip on snow and ice than what all-season these provide, and may have a softer rubber compound that remains flexible in extremely cold temperatures. Most and least satisfying tire retailers. A wide range of vendors from big back walk-in stores to online retailers sell tires for cars, SUVs, and trucks. Our most recent survey of CR members covering about 36,000 tire purchases and installation experiences shows the importance of choosing the right retailer. 90% of tire buyers said they were highly satisfied with their purchase, and 88% were highly satisfied with the installation. But there were clear differences among the retailers, with the top-rated ones pulling ahead of positive measures for sales staff, installation time, free perks, and checkout ease. The survey covered purchases from fall 2017 to fall 2018. Now, I'm going to run through this. It's an interesting chart because it's in a circle, so I've got to kind of spin it, so forgive me a little bit here. The top four rankings all got 91 or 90. Les Schwab Tire Centers, Discount Tire Direct, Independent Retailers, and America's Tire. The following all got 80, starting with 89 for Discount Tire Centers, 89 for Costco Wholesale, 89 for Tire Rack, 89 for Discount Tire and Automotive, 88 for Amazon.com, 88 for Kahl Tire, that's K-A-L Tire, 87 for Sullivan Tire, 87 for Dunn Tire, 87 for BJ's Wholesale Club, 86 for Goodyear Auto Service, 86 for Car Dealerships, 86 for Sam's Club, 86 for Tire Warehouse, 85 for Bell Tire, Big O Tires got an 84, 83 for Firestone Complete Auto Care, 83 for Tire Discounters, and 83 for Town Fair Tire. The following got lower 80s, starting with 82 and going down to 78. Sears got an 82, Tires Plus got an 82, Tire Kingdom got an 82. Walmart Auto Center only got 81. Mr. Tire only got 81. Canadian Tire got 81. NTB Tire and Service Center got 78. Mavis Discount Tire and Pep Boys both got 78s. And since we still have a considerable amount of time to go, I'm going to start on another Consumer Reports. So let's go a letter from the President. A bitter pill to swallow. As consumers, we know the difference between products we want and products we need. For luxury or convenience items, it's easy enough to hold off on a purchase if our budget demands it. But for things that we can't live without, waiting for a good deal isn't an option. That's why it's alarming for many Americans to see the prescription drugs they rely on increasing in price every year, with some reaching truly unaffordable heights. U.S. consumers often pay more for medication than people in other industrialized nations, a long-standing natural crisis that shows no sign of abating. In some cases, these price hikes force people to forego medication, miss payments on important bills, or seek out a second job. This month in our special report, The Shocking of RX Drug Prices, on page 38, which we'll read later on, not today, but next week probably, we break down the cost of prescription drugs to help you better understand why prices are rising so sharply. We outline the role that drug companies and insurers play, and we take a careful look at the role of the little-known industry middlemen called pharmacy benefit managers who play an outsized role in driving up consumer prices. While federal lawmakers have introduced dozens of bills to rein in costs, Congress has failed to bring any meaningful legislation across the finish line in an almost decade. But at the state level, there are signs of progress. In October, California's governor signed a pro-consumer bill prohibiting brand-name drug companies from pairing generic drug manufacturers to delay the introduction of their generics. And CR is advocating for similar legislation at the federal level. The consumers cannot put their medications on hold while politics play out, which is why we're offering some important tips to help you lower your prescription medication costs in the short term. You might not have much of a choice when it comes to taking your medicine. That's why CR is fighting hard to make sure you can get what you need without emptying your wallet or sacrificing your health. And building a better world together. More truth in cable charges. What's at stake? Imagine your surprise if you learned in the supermarket checkout line that the cereal you wanted to buy would incur a cardboard box surcharge and a grain refinery fee, adding nearly 25% of purchase price. It sounds absurd, but it isn't very difficult for many consumers to experience each time they pay their monthly cable bill. That's because pay TV companies have increasingly imposed new fees for services once included in the base rates we see quoted in ads. With names such as broadcast TV fee and regional sports surcharge, these add-ons even hit consumers, though they'd locked in long-term fixed-rate contracts. These tactics camouflage price increases and stymie consumers' efforts to comparison shop and maintain household budgets. How CR has your back. To determine just how big a problem these fees are, CR asked consumers to send their cable bills. We then analyzed nearly 800 bills. The results were staggering. We found that company-imposed fees, which do not include regulatory charges or taxes, in effect added 24% surcharge on top of the advertised prices and cost the average consumer nearly $450 per year. The report also made clear that providers often bury the fees deep in the line fine print of monthly bills, often provide confusing or inadequate information about fees to prospective customers, and sometimes inaccurately blame the government for them. The findings add momentum to the CR-backed True Fees Act currently pending in Congress, which, among other things, would require telecom providers to advertise a single price inclusive of all fees. CR's report, tweeted to co-sponsor Senator Richard Blumenthal, Democratic Connecticut, sheds light on why cable is now dramatically more expensive and putting increasing financial pressure on families for no good reason. What you can do, sign our petition demanding the telephone companies eliminate hidden fees and clearly advertise the full price of a service at cr.org/cablefees0120. Ending hidden hotel fees. What's at stake? In 2012-2013, the FTC issued warnings to 34 hotels and 11 online travel agencies, asking them to refrain from charging resort fees that weren't disclosed under advertised prices. Yet 7 years later, this deceptive practice, which makes accurately budgeting for travel expenses all but impossible, remains widespread. Halsey hires your back. But the tide may now be turning on resort fees. A recent CR investigation found that 31 of the 34 hotels targeted by the FTC continued to charge resort fees and failed to include them when recording prices, and that none of the 10 online agencies still operating include reverse fees in their additional quoted prices. A month later, a bipartisan bill was introduced into U.S. House of Representatives that, if passed, would require all fees to be disclosed in advance. In addition, in July, the Attorney General for Washington, D.C., filed a lawsuit accusing hotel giant Marriott International of price deception in a way it lists resort fees. And a similar suit was filed by Nebraska's Attorney General against Hilton later that month. What you can do. For tips on avoiding hotel fees, go to cr.org/hotelfees0120 and tell us your own hidden fee story at cr.org. Keep drug costs in check. What's at stake? The rising cost of prescription drugs is a daily challenge for many Americans. The average annual cost of a brand-name drug has more than tripled in over just over a decade, jumping from 1868 in 2008 to 6798 in 2017, according to the AARP Public Policy Institute. One way people can save money on drugs is to choose a lower-priced generic version. But brand-name pharmaceutical companies can stifle such competition through a practice called pay-for-delay, whereby they cut deals with makers of generic drugs to delay putting the generics on the market. A 2010 Federal Trade Commission study projected that these deals would cost consumers $3.5 billion in higher drug costs per year for 10 years. How CR has your back. CR has repeatedly advocated against pay-for-delay schemes. In October, California governor signed a CR-endorsed law that prohibits these agreements by declaring them presumptively anti-competitive. What you can do. For more information plus tips on keeping your drug costs in check, see the shocking rise of Rx drug prices, which we will read later on next week or the following week. And since we're getting close to running out of time here, let's do some humorous stuff. Three employees who made their respective office Christmas parties memorable. The man who tried to photocopy his rear end only to smash the glass and end up in the hospital. The manager who took his staff out for a three-course Christmas meal and had an emergency when dessert arrived, leaving his team with the bill. The poor soul who fell asleep on the toilet at a restaurant and woke up to find the entire place was empty and he was locked in. I was describing my job as an engineer to some middle schoolers when I mentioned that one of my colleagues and I designed a medical instrument for measuring human muscle tone. Later I added another colleague and I designed a system to allow merchants to print coupons at the cash register. Thinking that all this technical talk was confusing, I asked any questions. There was one. What's a colleague? Upon finding a clearly plagiarized paper, I called the student into my office, pointing to my computer screen, and said, I found your entire paper online. Do you have anything you want to say about it? Her angry response, well, I paid my sister to write it, but I didn't think she'd plagiarize. When I was in the 8th grade, two kids stole the teacher's book with the test answers. But our teachers realized they had cheated on the test. How? They wrote, answers will vary for some of the questions. And with that, we've just about run out of time for today's episode of the Reader's Digest and Consumer Reports. Be sure to listen in next time. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. I'm Jim Cronin, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. So long until next time, and thanks so much for listening.